Tim Versalotti, we're a few weeks past the January 6th siege on the Capitol. What went through your mind when you saw that event unfolding and in the aftermath when we've learned just how much worse it could have been?
It's interesting, Alan. As a college professor, I try to keep my political views to myself in the classroom. And when I have the privilege to speak with you on Congressional Corner, I approach it as objectively as possible because my personal views really aren't all that important. It's my professional assessment of things. I found all of that very difficult. I found that divide very difficult to maintain on January 6th. I was watching those events like everyone else was, as an American, as opposed to a dispassionate political analyst. And I found it very difficult and a very emotional experience. Anyone who has visited the Capitol, who has revered that building for what it represents, felt revulsion, anger, sadness on that day. And I was certainly among those folks. I found that very difficult to watch and process and view outside of just a state of shock and dismay like everyone else.
There are some people who are saying that there were utterances. One example, we got to find Mike Pence, parenthesis, maybe kill him. We got to find Nancy Pelosi. It could have been a lot worse, couldn't it?
It absolutely could have. And I have to applaud the press for their investigative work, just putting pieces together, looking at information, looking at who was involved, looking at some of the warning signs on social media that perhaps the rest of us were not as tuned into. And I hope that that continues so that the evidence becomes more and more concrete, not just who was behind it, but who was carrying it out and with what objectives in mind. It's hard to separate fact from speculation. And so we count on the news media to help us do that sorting. It pretty scary stuff, though. If you think about what was occurring, it was certifying the winners of the presidential election. Routine, ceremonial matter that almost never merits a great deal of comment and coverage in the press. And the notion that essentially a mob would disrupt that and send the members of Congress literally fleeing for their safety, just mind-boggling. I just think there's so much more to the story still to be unearthed and told. And I am encouraged that leaders in the Congress are going to engage in systematic investigation just so we get a clear sense of what actually happened on that day.
Well, when you look at the way this all is coming down, it comes down to, did Trump incite them to do that? And that's the basis of the impeachment trial.
It is. If you read the article of impeachment, it's very straightforward, very brief. 5 pages in length, but the first page and a half are the names of the co-sponsors in the House, and there were many. The article is incitement of insurrection, and it speaks to the president's statements, public statements at the rally prior to the attack on the Capitol. It also speaks to the president's actions in the days leading up. The article includes a reference to the president's infamous phone call with the Secretary of State in Georgia, that hour-long conversation where the president urges the Secretary of State to go find the votes that Trump would need to flip the state from Biden to Trump in the Electoral College. To the extent that the upcoming impeachment trial will examine these events, we might learn more if the Democrats decide to call witnesses and if they can negotiate an agreement in that regard in terms of how they will conduct the trial, negotiating with the Republicans. It could be a more enlightening experience than the first impeachment trial, where there were no witnesses, the key witnesses were covered by executive privilege, and the trial didn't shed a whole lot of new light. This trial, it could be very different. We'll have to see.
Let me go to a different place. COVID, has this changed the way you and other pollsters do your jobs?
It sure has. One of the things, when you're running a telephone survey, most call centers are in a room with a couple of dozen folks talking on telephones. And no matter how well ventilated that room is, no matter how many precautions you take, it's a tricky thing to have a lot of people speaking on the phone simultaneously in a room. So a lot of centers have begun remote work, and we're one of them, where I train the interviewers on Zoom, I monitor them remotely, they're making calls, I'm listening to the calls, but we're scattered. The interviewers are working from home, generally in a safe place, and many, many call centers around the country are doing that. Others are shifting to online data collection, not using live interviewers, and that's also because of plummeting response rates to telephone surveys. But yes, we all have had to revisit how we do our work in the age of COVID, that's for sure.
So why are there plummeting answering of these polls? When I'm approached, I almost always say, listen, you know, I'm a journalist. I can't talk to you about this. Thank you very much. But I'm assuming if you're telling me that a lot of people are saying, I won't answer these questions, there's got to be a reason.
Sure. And some of it is simply wanting privacy and just not picking up if they see a strange number calling in. Because more and more people only have cell phones, it's also possible to obtain cell phone apps that will block numbers that aren't in your contact list on your phone. That makes it harder and harder to get people. We found in the polling in the presidential election in the fall that there was also more of a hesitance on the part of Republicans just to pick up. And although some people would call that shy Trump voters, it was broader than that. It was folks who are just lower, perhaps lower in trust of institutions in general, the media, the government, and now survey researchers as well. Those are big challenges that we have to face. And you can't address those simply by saying, well, I'll mathematically weight up by education, by partisanship. We've got to find a way to win back the trust of those folks and convince them that participating in surveys is really an important public service that everybody benefits from.
I want to talk to you a little bit about my friend Richie Neal and Jim McGovern over in the next adjoining district. How are they doing? Is it your sense? I mean, Neal had a tough election and he really whumped the other guy. It was quite something. Can you tell us anything about how they're doing popularity-wise?
Well, in the sense that they both easily won re-election, there hasn't been a lot of congressional district-level polling, but there are margins of victory for Neal in the primary in September against Alex Morse, the mayor of Holyoke, and then McGovern, Jim McGovern did have a general election opponent in November. They both won easily. They seem to be, still be very popular in their district. It is interesting, though, the Neal Morse race. There was a lot going on. There were allegations among college Democrats that perhaps Mayor Morse was participating in their activities in a way that overlapped into his personal life as well. The University of Massachusetts commissioned an independent investigation into that because Mayor Morse also was an adjunct instructor on the campus. What the investigation found was that Alex Morse had not violated any university policies in terms of dating students he was also directly supervising or teaching. And Mayor Morse found this to be a exoneration of sorts. And it's interesting where he goes from here. He's not seeking another term. It may help his future, depending on where he goes in public life. He became very well known among progressive circles for taking on Richard Neal, and it'll be interesting to see what his next move is. Neal, as chair of Ways and Means, has a lot of important tasks ahead of him. The Biden administration is going to send legislation undoing some of the Trump tax cuts and raising the tax rate for Americans earning more than $400,000 a year, and raise the capital gains rate on folks making more than $1 million per year. All of that goes to the Ways and Means Committee, which writes this policy. So we will see Congressman Neal in the public spotlight in the coming months.
It's been great talking again with Tim Versalotti, director of the Western New England University Poll, professor of political science, a guy who anybody who has him as a professor is going to be very lucky. In any case, Tim, thank you for being with us. And when we come back the next time, I got lots more.
Thank you, Alan.